to help heal the nation. He participated directly in the allocation of funds by sitting on the committee that evaluated the competing projects submitted by the two men. He listened attentively when Hopkins argued that heavy projects Ickes favored took too much time to develop, that with the higher cost of materials, a lower percentage of dollars went directly into the pockets of people. He shared Ickes' concern that Hopkins could not carefully oversee the tens of thousands of small projects he had initiated, exposing them to the risk of inefficiency, potential graft, and diminished congressional support. As the Depression continued, month after month, however, Roosevelt found himself siding more frequently with Hopkins. Roosevelt had always been susceptible to the stories of people's lives, rather than statistically driven macro projects. Hopkins had a host of such stories for Roosevelt. How the provision of a government job had rehabilitated an entire family, or how a WPA project had delivered a playground, park, or swimming pool to a grateful community. As appropriations tilted more to favor Hopkins' myriad projects, Roosevelt was forced to placate Ickes. In his diary, Ickes records numerous occasions when he had resolved to resign, only to be reeled back into the fold by the unaffected simplicity and personal charm of the man. Here was the President of the United States patiently listening to his side of the story, all the while being dressed with the help of his valet, yet remaining relaxed, focused, and empathetic to his personal grievances.
"What could a man do with a president like that?" Ickes later said.
Long smoldering antagonisms eventually ignited in public view. Ickes referred to WPA projects as make-work and leaf-raking. Hopkins counterpunched, railing against the constant delays in the Interior Secretary's construction projects. While the president valued, even fomented, such arguments within his official family, he was less than pleased when feuds surfaced in newspapers. Within short order, he invited both Ickes and Hopkins to accompany him on a speaking tour across the country, followed by a cruise through the Panama Canal. The two men spent days and nights together with the president, game fishing in the shoals off Mexico, palavering, playing poker, drinking martinis. Both men thoroughly enjoyed the intimacy of the unusual month-long trip. Once again, Ickes marveled at the high cheer of Roosevelt's disposition, as he was being carried up and down like a helpless child when he went fishing. Hopkins told his brother he had a perfectly grand time and felt really rested. In the ship's daily newspaper, the Blue Bonnet, a curious news item appeared entitled "Buried at Sea." Its sprightly style pointed directly to the old newspaperman, Roosevelt himself. "The feud between Hopkins and Ickes was given a decent burial today. With flags at half-mast, the president officiated at the solemn ceremony, which we trust will take these two babies off the front page for all time. Hopkins expressed regret at the unkind things Ickes had said about him, and Ickes, on his part, promised to make it stronger, only more so, as soon as he could get a stenographer who would take it down hot. The president gave them a hearty slap on the back, pushing them both into the sea. 'Full steam ahead,' the president ordered." Open channels of unfiltered information to supplement and challenge official sources. Don't confuse what people in Washington are saying for what people in the country are feeling, Roosevelt repeatedly counseled his aides. "Go and see what's happening. See the end product of what we're doing. Talk to people. Get the wind in your nose." If the unprecedented conditions demanded the creation of new and untried programs, Roosevelt, as chief administrator, had to figure out which of these programs were working and which were not. such evaluations were not likely to bubble up through formal channels. To prevent imprisonment within the official pipelines of information, Roosevelt set in motion a nationwide reconnaissance. He tapped all manner of unorthodox sources of intelligence that allowed him to alter, discard, or revamp existing programs on the fly. Although he began his day by consuming a half dozen metropolitan papers, like a combine eating up grain, he relied on his longtime secretary, Lewis Howe, to cut and paste a digest of articles and editorials culled from newspapers from small villages and towns across the country. Through this daily bugle, as it was called, Roosevelt absorbed a more personalized sounding of what people were feeling about individual New Deal programs. Similar clippings were compiled from the torrent of letters that reached the White House. Somewhere between 6,000 and 8,000 letters every day after Roosevelt let it be known that he wanted to hear directly from the people. Eleanor also asked people to write her, citing the danger that a public figure may be set apart from the stream of life affecting the country. Her daily column not only dispensed advice, but received opinions and suggestions from the people. She, like her husband, had opened two-way communications. More than any other source, Roosevelt counted on Eleanor to provide the unvarnished truth. He called her his will-o'-the-wisp wife, for she traveled hundreds of thousands of miles around the country, spending weeks and months at a time talking with a great variety of people from every region, listening to complaints, examining New Deal programs, amassing an anthology of stories. Each time she returned, she arranged an uninterrupted meal with her husband so the anecdotes would be fresh and not dulled by repetition. Roosevelt had absolute trust in the dependability and accuracy of her observations. She saw many things the president could never see, Frances Perkins said. Much of what she learned and what she understood about the life of the people of this country rubbed off onto the president. Cabinet secretaries often heard Roosevelt's refrain, "My missus gets around a lot," he would say. "My missus says that people are working for wages way below the minimum set by NRA in the town she visited last week." Eleanor's reports mobilized Roosevelt to streamline programs, sharpen their effectiveness, and sometimes create altogether new agencies. The Agricultural Adjustment Administration, AAA, had begun paying farmers to destroy their crops and slaughter animals in an attempt to raise the depressed farm prices that had created untold suffering in rural areas. "Why do you dump all these little pigs into the Mississippi when there are thousands of people in the country starving?" Eleanor pointedly asked an administrator. Her appalled observations about the wasteful aspects of the AAA program led to the creation of a new agency, the Federal Surplus Relief Corporation. The government purchased surplus wheat, corn, meat, and cotton, and then distributed the excess commodities to relief agencies to feed and clothe the unemployed. While bringing fresh sources of information from outside, Franklin Roosevelt churned up the normal flow of information from inside as well. Told about an interesting young subordinate in a bureau, he was likely to invite that employee to the White House, disrupting the chain of command and often irking the department's chief. Roosevelt habitually read more deeply into people than in books. Conversation afforded him the occasion to work out his own thoughts. "In the course of the average day," Roosevelt said, "I come in contact with representatives of about half the federal relief agencies personally, or by telephone, or by correspondence. I try to keep in touch with the coordinating of all our work as much as is humanly possible." Memos, were tailored to winnow down the mountains of data that piled up every hour. I learned to prepare material so that it would photograph itself upon his memory, Francis Perkins said. Recommendations for action should be short, preferably one page, presented in outline form, revealing who was in favor, who opposed, and why. But what he wanted most of all, she knew, were the particular stories of ordinary people. These stories indelibly tattooed his memory. Adapt. Be ready to change course quickly when necessary. I do not deny that we may make mistakes of procedure, Roosevelt had said when he first outlined plans for systemic changes in his second fireside chat. I have no expectation of making a hit every time I come to bat. What I seek is the highest possible batting average, not only for myself, but for the team. Repeatedly, he told staffers prone to stress about the magnitude of the tasks before them that so long as they considered every angle as best they could in the time they had, there was no use agonizing over whether they were right or wrong. You and I know people who wear out the carpet walking up and down worrying whether they have decided something correctly, Roosevelt confided to Roseman. Do the very best you can in making up your mind, but once your mind is made up, go ahead. Such adaptability, the willingness to shift ground, revise, and accommodate the contours of changing circumstances, can be discerned as an animating principle, threading through the scores of programs set forth during the 100 days and beyond. Some of these programs would remain a permanent part of the federal government, including the TVA, Tennessee Valley Authority, FHA, Federal Housing Administration, and FCC, Federal Communications Commission. Others would be disbanded once the mobilization for war rendered them unnecessary. Among them, the CWA, Civil Works Administration, PWA, Public Works Administration, WPA, Works Progress Administration, NYA, National Youth Administration. Readiness to adapt played a central role in enabling Roosevelt to fulfill the pledge he had made at the height of the banking crisis, to follow recovery with reform, to uproot old abuses in both the unregulated stock market and the banking system so they would not reoccur. He took his first stab at regulating the stock market with the Truth in Securities Act, designed, he said, to guard investors against false information in the selling of securities. Having seen so much misery come to honest families who had been persuaded to invest their savings in speculative securities masquerading under the name of investments and sold by high-pressure methods, he had come to the conclusion, Roosevelt said, that national legislation was a necessity. The act required issuers of new securities to file complete registration statements with the Federal Trade Commission. Deliberate misrepresentation would be subject to up to 5 years imprisonment. The bill angered people on both the right and the left. While businessmen warned that the draconian punishments determined by amateurs at the Federal Trade Commission would so restrain brokers that the market would be stalled, further retarding recovery, reformers were profoundly disappointed that all stocks and bonds already issued were exempted from regulation. Realizing within 6 months that the bill was unworkable, Roosevelt set out immediately to loosen up the constrictions and to extend federal regulation over the whole field of stocks and bonds, not simply the new issuances. The act called for a wide range of specific prohibitions against all forms of stock manipulation. It proposed the creation of a new regulatory body, the Securities and Exchange Commission, SEC, to be comprised of five commissioners appointed for 5 years. Business leaders reacted with outrage at the idea of putting a government cop on their corner. The New York Stock Exchange threatened to move to Montreal. Roosevelt sent a special letter to Congress, warning that a more highly organized drive had formed against this bill than any other New Deal legislation. If any attempt were made to weaken or scuttle the bill, he warned, the members would have to answer to the American people, who were fully aware that unregulated speculation had helped precipitate the unwarranted boom and the terrible years that followed the crash. The bill easily passed, and eventually the SEC became one of the most admired of the New Deal agencies. Legislation to regulate the banking community was finally signed into law on day 99 of the 100 days. The Glass-Steagall Act offered prophylactic reforms to check the signal abuses contributing to the banking crisis. That crisis had arisen, Roosevelt believed, when banks were unable to meet withdrawal demands because they had used depositors' funds to speculate in an overheated stock market. The new bill required banks to make a choice. They could pursue either commercial activities or investment banking, but henceforth they were forbidden to do both. During the debate on the bill, the Senate added an amendment calling for the federal government, in conjunction with insurance premiums placed on banks, to guarantee deposits up to a certain limit, which would shift over time. Roosevelt strongly objected to this guarantee. In a written note, he asked the members of the House Senate Conference Committee to reject the amendment. "It won't work," he insisted, convinced that the weak banks will pull down the strong. He even threatened to veto the entire bill unless the amendment to guarantee deposits was defeated. Nonetheless, after a contentious debate, the bill finally passed with the amendment intact. Roosevelt at once telephoned congratulations to Senator Glass, and at the signing ceremony joked that the bill had more lives than a cat. "A good-natured admission," Moley observed, "of his ultimate defeat on deposit insurance." Yet within a matter of months, Roosevelt realized that his staunch opposition to guaranteed deposits had been wrong-headed. The creation of the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, FDIC, gave depositors the security they needed. Over 90% of banks purchased the insurance by 1934, and within 5 years, deposits had increased by nearly 50%. According to monetary historians, federal insurance of bank deposits was the most important structural change to result from the 1933 panic, the most conducive to monetary stability. In both these cases, Roosevelt tinkered with his original proposals and proved willing to compromise. The Securities and Exchange Act softened the severity of penalties, while widening the field that would constitute transgression. After opposing the FDIC, Roosevelt gracefully accepted it, and in the end, embraced it as his own successful and legitimate child. Nothing was set in stone. Nothing was final. For FDR, decision-making and administration were parts of a living process. "We have to do the best we know how to do at the moment. If it doesn't work out," he assured Perkins, "we can modify it as we go along." Given this penchant for improvisation, alteration, and modification, given the imaginative and proliferating nature of this template of supple leadership, it is unsurprising that Roosevelt is so often likened to a creative artist. "A real artist in government," according to the playwright Robert Sherwood.
As an artist of the turnaround, Roosevelt had no finished model or maquette before him to enlarge and then impose upon the country. Rather, Perkins observed, he worked with the materials and problems at hand, and as he worked with one phase, the next evolved. And as one project after another took shape, so his deftness and skill continued to flourish. His intuitive touch became more confident and refined, just as the country's confidence and trust in him and in themselves grew stronger. At the close of the 100 days, when the special session of the 73rd Congress finally adjourned on June 16th, Roosevelt let his gratitude be known. He spoke in praise of the spirit of teamwork that had transcended party lines. He paid tribute to the wholehearted cooperation between the legislative and executive branches that had embraced a new approach to problems both new and old, and has proven that our form of government can rise to an emergency and can carry through a program in record time. When war came, Roosevelt liked to say that Dr. New Deal had metamorphosed into Dr. Win the War. While the two doctors faced different challenges, they shared the same practice, as well as the same DNA of leadership, a temperament that did not wear out the carpet worrying, that relaxed and thought out problems while conversing, that relished the joy of exercising leadership itself. When something desperate needed doing, both doctors leapt into the fray. The doctor who set a target of enrolling 250,000 young people in the CCC in but 3 months' time made a dramatic call 7 years later for a staggering annual productive capacity of 50,000 planes to put America ahead of Germany within a single year. What at first seemed a preposterous goal proved a psychological target to lift sights, fire the imagination of team members, and galvanize the home front into accomplishing the unobtainable. The educator, who had lucidly explained the labyrinthine complexity of the banking crisis in his first fireside chat, would later ask the nation to spread a global map of the theater of war upon their tables, so he could point out something about geography, what our problem is, and what the overall strategy of the war has to be, how each battle fits into the picture. Roosevelt's gift of communication proved the vital instrument of his success in developing a common mission, clarifying problems, mobilizing action, and earning the people's trust. His faith never foundered, that if the people were taken into the confidence of their government and received a full and truthful statement of what was happening, they would generally choose the right course. This reciprocal connection between Roosevelt and the people he served lay at the heart of his leadership. Indeed, if ever an argument can be made for the conclusive importance of the character and intelligence of the leader in fraught times, at home and abroad, it will come to rest on the broad shoulders of Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
Chapter 12, Visionary Leadership. Lyndon Johnson and Civil Rights. Everything was in chaos, Lyndon Johnson recalled of the hours and days following Kennedy's assassination. One shocking event cascaded into the next as the country watched in real time, aghast, the announcement that shots had been fired at Kennedy's motorcade, confirmation of the president's death, the arrest and subsequent murder of Lee Harvey Oswald, the identification of Dallas nightclub owner Jack Ruby as the murderer, the speculation that both murders were part of a larger conspiracy related to Russia, Cuba, or the Mafia. For 4 days, from the assassination to the funeral, Americans remained transfixed before television screens as the three networks canceled all regular programming to cover the news. This unfolding tragedy presented Lyndon Johnson with extreme danger, yet also an unprecedented opportunity for action and judgment. A successful transition called for both the establishment of immediate command and the symbolic assurance of continuity. "The times cried out for leadership," Johnson later said. A nation stunned, shaken to its very heart, had to be reassured that the government was not in a state of paralysis. And beyond the nation, the whole world would be anxiously following every move I made, watching, judging, weighing. As such, it was imperative that I grasp the reins of power and do so without delay. Any hesitation or wavering, any false step, any sign of self-doubt could have been disastrous. We were all spinning around and around, trying to come to grips with what had happened, but the more we tried to understand it, the more confused we got. We were like a bunch of cattle caught in the swamp, unable to move in either direction, simply circling round and round. With this imagery, Johnson harked back to his childhood in the Texas Hill Country, to the stories his grandfather told. "I knew what had to be done," Johnson continued. "There's but one way to get the cattle out of the swamp, and that is for the man on the horse to take the lead, to assume command, to provide direction. In the period of confusion after the assassination, I was that man." Even as he showed strength and assurance to the public at large, however, he exhibited modesty and deference to Kennedy's inner circle. In contrast to Theodore Roosevelt, who in the wake of McKinley's assassination had 3 years to gain his footing before facing the electorate in his own right, Johnson had less than a year before the next election. There was no time to build a new team from scratch. Furthermore, the retention of the important Kennedy men signaled respect and steadiness. In this contradictory role of beseeching power, as humble apprentice striving gradually to attain mastery, Johnson had long excelled. Johnson approached each of the Kennedy men. "I know how much he needed you. I need you that much more, and so does our country." Never once did he suggest that however things were done before, this was now his White House. "I knew how they felt," he later said. "Suddenly, they were outsiders just as I had been for almost 3 years. Outsiders on the inside." Checking his storied arrogance, softening his tone, he conveyed a deep humility, sharing his doubts, continuously requesting patience, advice, and assistance. "There is much I don't know," he would say. "You must teach me." That so many key figures of Kennedy's cabinet and White House staff remained during the transition testified to the perfect pitch he displayed during this fraught transition. So faultless was Johnson's performance upon his assumption of leadership that it appeared as if he had long rehearsed what he would do if he held the power and the time were ripe. Suddenly the time was right. He chanced to hold the power, and he intended to use it. Everyone agreed that Lyndon Johnson was a master mechanic of the legislative process. What became apparent from the first hours of his presidency, however, was that he meant to use these unparalleled skills in the service of a full-blown vision of the role government should play in the lives of the people. From the outset, he knew exactly where he wanted to take the country in domestic affairs, and he had a working idea of how to get there. After landing in the nation's capital at 6 p.m. of the day of the assassination, he reached out by phone to scores of people, including former presidents Harry Truman and Dwight Eisenhower, and met with a delegation of congressional leaders in his vice presidential office in the executive office building. At 10 p.m., he returned to the Elms, his three-story residence in Spring Valley, Washington, with a small group of advisors and friends. "Spend the night with me," he entreated three close aides, Jack Valenti, Cliff Carter, and Bill Moyers. More than ever, he did not want to be alone. After this cataclysmic day, he especially needed an intimate circle of listeners to sort out his thoughts and to get his bearings. An hour later, after Lady Bird went to sleep in her own bedroom, Johnson put on his pajamas and, with the three men propped beside him on his immense bed, held forth as they all watched the non-stop reportage of the world-riveting story on the television. In the early morning hours, Valenti recalled, "The new president began to ruminate aloud about his plans, his objectives, the great goals he was bound to attain. In his mind's eye, he could already envision a future in which all of Kennedy's progressive legislation, then deadlocked in Congress, had become law. 'I'm going to get Kennedy's tax cut out of the Senate Finance Committee, and we're going to get this economy humming again. Then I'm going to pass Kennedy's civil rights bill, which has been hung up too long in the Congress, and I'm going to pass it without changing a single comma or a word. After that, we'll pass legislation that allows everyone anywhere in the country to vote with all the barriers down. And that's not all. We're going to get a law that says every boy and girl in this country, no matter how poor or the color of their skin or the region they come from, is going to be able to get all the education they can take by loan, scholarship, or grant, right from the federal government. And I aim to pass Harry Truman's medical insurance bill that got nowhere before.' The somnolent vice president seemed magically reawakened as he revealed a rudimentary sketch of what would become the Great Society. This might seem an apocryphal tale had not three aides been there until 3 a.m. to witness his fierce resolve, not simply to dislodge Kennedy's stalled agenda, but to realize a society built on racial and economic justice far beyond the dreams of the New Deal and the New Frontier. The vision Johnson traced in those pre-dawn hours had been incubating for many decades. From his populist father, he had inherited the belief that the role of government was to look after those who needed help. "That's what we're here for," his father had repeatedly reminded his son. The seminal concept that government should use its power to better the lives of others had been consolidated during his work in Roosevelt's New Deal. It was further enumerated in his call to arms speech in the wake of his near-fatal heart attack and informed his maneuvers to pass the 1957 Civil Rights Bill. "That whole night," Moyers recalled of Johnson's musings at the Elms, "he seemed to have several chambers of his mind operating simultaneously. It was formidable, very formidable." How was Johnson able to actualize this vision? Make a dramatic start. Lyndon Johnson's most important task, the necessary condition upon which all else hinged, was to convince his countrymen that he was capable of filling the brutally sudden vacuum of leadership. He had to dispel doubts, quell suspicions, and allay fears. In this time of dark national emergency, the new president was inclined by temperament to act quickly. At each new position in his long career, he had sought a quick, sure start, an attention-fastening moment. Now, the day after Kennedy's burial, he chose to make a major speech to the nation. This choice was not without risk, for with few exceptions, Johnson had revealed an inability to speak persuasively in large formal settings. The man who could exercise instant command over any small gathering had tended to stiffen when forced to stand behind a podium, and this address would be the most important he had ever delivered. He knew, Moyer said, that the people watching it were burning with questions, wondering, "Who is that man?" When he stepped off the podium, they would either have confidence in him or not. Lead with your strengths. From the start, Johnson made two important decisions. First, he would deliver his speech before a live audience at a joint session of Congress rather than before a television camera in the empty Oval Office. Congress had been his home for more than three decades, the source of his security, achievement, and power. Many in the audience would be longtime friends and colleagues. Also in attendance would be the Supreme Court justices and the members of the cabinet, the full panoply of legitimate succession. Second, he would use the occasion to call upon his former colleagues to break the total legislative gridlock that had prevented every one of Kennedy's major domestic initiatives from becoming law. A month before the assassination, columnist Walter Lippmann had written that there was reason to wonder whether the congressional system as it now operates is not a grave danger to the republic. Indeed, as an editorial in Life magazine had pointed out, this Congress had sat longer than any previous body while accomplishing practically nothing. The inability of Congress to move legislation forward, Johnson agreed, was developing into a national crisis, exposing America's democratic system to widespread criticism at home and abroad. In choosing to focus on Kennedy's blocked domestic agenda, Johnson settled on the field where he felt most deeply involved, most confident of his knowledge, most comfortable in dealing with policy details. The arenas of foreign and military affairs, which had been the specialty and focus of the Kennedy administration, were uncongenial to him, and he was fortunate to come into office at an ostensibly tranquil moment in international affairs. If any sense were to come of the senseless events which had brought me to the office of the presidency, he later said, it would come only from my using my experience as a legislator to encourage the legislative process to function. Believing that Kennedy's death had created a sympathetic atmosphere for the passage of the stalled New Frontier agenda, Johnson planned to turn the dead man's program into a martyr's cause. But the window of opportunity was very small. If he had any chance of succeeding, he had to move ahead at warp speed before the supportive mood began to dissipate. Simplify the agenda. From the outset, Johnson decided to pare down Kennedy's domestic agenda to two essential items, the Civil Rights Bill designed to end segregation in the South, and the tax cut intended to stimulate the economy. Over many hours of conversation at the Elms, Johnson's advisors debated the wisdom of these choices. At one point, attorney Abe Fortas recalled, one of the men spoke up forcefully against recommending congressional action on civil rights, and most particularly against making it his number one priority. The presidency has only a certain amount of coinage to expend, he warned Johnson, and you oughtn't to expend it on this. It will never get through. Well, Johnson replied with an unambiguous answer, what the hell's the presidency for? When Johnson entered the House chamber at noon of November 27, 1963, a hush came over the audience. All that I have, he began, I would have given gladly not to be standing here today. With simple eloquence, he set a tone of sorrowful humility that would blend a funeral oration with an inaugural call for action. On the 20th day of January in 1961, John F. Kennedy told his countrymen that our national work would not be finished in the first 1,000 days, nor in the life of this administration, nor even perhaps in our lifetime on this planet. But, he said, let us begin. Today, in this moment of new resolve, I say to all my fellow Americans, let us continue. In contrast to the Kennedy inaugural, however, which presaged a resurgent America in the world's eye with no mention of domestic affairs, Johnson outlined his hopes for domestic policy with hardly a nod to foreign policy. First, no memorial oration or eulogy could more eloquently honor President Kennedy's memory than the earliest possible passage of the Civil Rights Bill for which he fought so long. We have talked long enough in this country about equal rights. We have talked for 100 years or more. It is time now to write the next chapter and to write it in the books of law. And second, no act of ours could more fittingly continue the work of President Kennedy than the early passage of the tax bill for which he fought all this long year. He firmly believed, Johnson said, in the ability of the Congress, despite the divisions of opinions which characterize our nation, to act wisely, to act vigorously, to act speedily when the need arises. The need is here. The need is now. I ask your help. In his call for action to fill the leadership vacuum, one journalist noted, Johnson appeared to have modeled himself after the man he has most admired in his political career, Franklin D. Roosevelt. Just as Roosevelt had called for action, and action now, to carry the people through a dark hour in their national life, so Johnson had exhorted us to show the world that we can and will act, and act now. Both men addressed a volatile, depressed, and fearful nation. Both men countered despondency and confusion, and sought to give hope, confidence, and renewed direction. And both men ministered to a stricken nation and uplifted the country's morale. By the time Johnson finished, the applauding audience was on its feet, many in tears. It was a remarkable performance, critics agreed, perfectly suitable to the most difficult circumstances, directly calculated to get results. Equal to the words of the address, his demeanor, measured pace, solemnity, and determination all conveyed that a genuine transference of power and purpose from the slain president to his successor had taken place. Headlines told the story. Leadership in good hands. Johnson emerges grave and strong. New chief met the test. Through this single speech, delivered to a nation still in mourning, Lyndon Johnson bridged what had seemed an impossible span. He had seized the reins of power and established a shared sense of direction and purpose for his sudden presidency. Established the most effective order of battle. While passage of the Civil Rights Bill was the foremost of Lyndon Johnson's two objectives, the tortuous legislative path to get there resembled a maze filled with false corridors, pitfalls, and dead ends. After speaking with congressmen and senators on the Hill, Johnson concluded that he should first push for the tax cut before contending with the far more divisive issue of civil rights. Kennedy's aide, Theodore Sorensen, disagreed with this order of battle. Sorensen reminded Johnson that as vice president, he had been absent from the last congressional leadership breakfast where the decision had been made to move first on civil rights. Johnson listened respectfully to Sorensen, but on this procedural issue, he trusted his own instincts and experience rather than that of the Kennedy team. A straightforward charge for civil rights would prevent both the civil rights bill and the tax cut from succeeding. Even if the civil rights bill could get through the Southern-dominated committee structure in the House, it would be stopped in the Senate, where Southern leaders were fully prepared to mount a filibuster, shutting down all other business until either the bill was withdrawn or its proponents managed to secure a two-thirds cloture vote to bring debate to an end. As long as the filibuster endured, no other piece of legislation could reach the floor. Such prolonged deadlock would only deepen the national crisis and severely wound the new administration's prospects. If the tax cut could be passed first, however, traction might beget a sense of momentum. With actual evidence of progress, the administration could then single-mindedly address civil rights. Yet success in enacting the tax bill was by no means certain. The bill had lingered in Congress for 13 months before its passage in the House, and was now firmly mired in the Senate Finance Committee, whose chairman, conservative Virginia Senator Harry Byrd, was guardian of the gate. The genteel Southerner had the power either to keep the bill locked in committee or to release it to the floor. At the time of Kennedy's death, in a reversal of future roles, support for corporate and individual tax cuts came from liberals and opposition from conservatives. Kennedy's young economic advisers argued that tax cuts would stimulate the economy and expand tax revenues, which could then fund a range of social programs. Conservatives preaching the gospel of the balanced budget were ideologically committed to the fight against deficits. And no one represented this old guard frugality more categorically than Harry Byrd, who had elevated reduction of government spending into a crusade. Searching for whatever might pry the bill from Byrd's clutches, Johnson ceaselessly worked the phone with various members of the Finance Committee. From Florida's George Smathers, he gleaned that Byrd was determined to hold the bill in hearings until he could carefully evaluate the upcoming budget due on January 9th. If that budget exceeded $100 billion, a magic line for him, he would prevent the bill from leaving his committee. With this knowledge, Johnson suddenly saw the glimmer of an opening. If he could shave the budget below the psychological barrier of $100 billion, perhaps a deal could be made that might allow the bill to come to the floor, even if Byrd would eventually vote against it. In his courtship of Byrd, Lyndon Johnson spared nothing. On December 4th, less than 2 weeks after Kennedy's assassination, Johnson invited Byrd to the White House. "Harry, why don't you come down here and see me tomorrow? I want to get some of your wisdom." A presidential limousine met the senator outside the Senate office building. The president personally greeted him upon his arrival and then played tour guide through the West Wing, the swimming pool, and the massage room, until they settled down in the small room adjoining the Oval Office for an intimate lunch over Byrd's favorite potato soup and vanilla ice cream. After reminiscing about old Senate days, the mannerly haggling began. "Harry, that tax cut is important to me, mightily important," Johnson began. "You know that we cannot have a tax cut without serious decreases in the budget," Byrd countered. "Yes," Johnson agreed, "but my latest studies tell me that I would be fortunate, really fortunate, if I could get it down below $105 or $107 billion. Both men knew he was starting high in the manner of all country dickering. The working Kennedy budget was $103 billion, leaving a deficit of more than $10 billion. "Too big, Mr. President, too big," said Byrd. "Well, Harry, just suppose, and I say just suppose because I don't think it can realistically be done, just suppose I could get the budget down somewhere under $100 billion. What would you say then?" "In that case," Byrd answered, "we might be able to do some business." Knowing that Byrd was a man of his word, Johnson summarily stood up and offered his hand. "Harry, you have made a deal. It's been good seeing you. I don't see enough of you." He then gently ushered Byrd to the door. Honor commitments. Now the hard work of budget paring commenced. Members of Kennedy's team told him that they had whittled it down as far as they could. There was no fat left, they warned. Any more cutting would hit muscle and bone. But Johnson was adamant. "Unless you get to $100 billion, Johnson warned everyone, "you will not pee one drop." "I worked as hard on that budget as I have worked on anything," Johnson recalled. "I studied almost every line, nearly every page, until I was dreaming about the budget at night." He recognized that to the ordinary citizen, the federal budget was a boggling compilation of statistics, thicker than a Sears Roebuck catalog and duller than a telephone directory. But to a president responsible for setting priorities, it was a human document affecting the daily lives of every American. For Lyndon Johnson, as for Franklin Roosevelt, people lived behind the figures, people hoping for some form of aid from their government. The campaign Johnson launched to reduce government expenditures cast a wide net. He consolidated federal buildings upon land the government already owned, ordered agencies to buy in bulk, and turned out lights in the White House, earning him the nickname Lightbulb Lyndon. More significantly, he sent memos to each department, including the Pentagon, demanding lists of cuts. So intent was he to jumpstart his domestic agenda that the largest cuts, more than $1 billion, came from the Defense Department under Secretary Robert McNamara. Byrd had told the president he would have to see the budget in writing and have sufficient time for his staff to analyze it before he allowed the tax bill to move forward. Fully aware that Byrd's team would spot any gimmicks, Johnson reduced the budget down to $97.5 billion, leaving plenty of room for argument. "You can tell your grandchildren you were the senator who finally got a president to cut his budget." He wanted Byrd to understand that future judgment would be rendered upon this achievement, and he was more than willing to share the credit if it would enhance and speed along the present objective. All along, Johnson knew that reciprocal trust was of paramount importance. So long as he fulfilled his promise, Byrd would keep his end of the deal. And in early February, the chairman finally released the bill from his committee to the floor. Still, time remained of the essence. The ordinary legislative process to move the bill forward through debate on the Senate floor, onto a vote, and then to the conference committee with the House might take weeks or even months. If this lengthy pace of business prevailed, if, as Johnson worried, they just procrastinate and put off and shimmy around, then the window of opportunity to harness public sentiment for the martyred president would surely close. Drive, drive, drive. No detail of the legislative process eluded him, White House aide Larry O'Brien said of Lyndon Johnson. Every day, every hour, it was drive, drive, drive. No sooner had Byrd's committee voted to send the bill to the floor than Johnson called the chief committee clerk, Elizabeth Springer, to urge her to make all haste writing the majority and minority reports to send to the floor. How soon could the report be completed, he inquired. Told it would take about a week, Johnson asked, "Are they working any at night?" "Tell everyone," he said, "he would provide overtime." Thrilled by hearing directly from the president, Springer called back to promise that the report would be completed in 3 days. "Oh, that's wonderful. I love you," Johnson told her. Immediately, he placed a call to the government printing office to rush the printing of the report. "There's a crew working tonight," the printer assured Johnson. "We'll keep the plant open and get the job done." Once the bill reached the floor, Johnson worked with individual senators to hold the line against the attachment of a single amendment, which would open the floodgates and delay the process. He pushed all his cabinet officers to lean on wavering senators. To those who had planned to attend a foreign policy conference on NATO, he made it clear that he didn't look with very much favor on their hightailing it around the world. The job they needed to focus upon was on Capitol Hill, not in Europe. Once the bill passed the Senate, he turned to the chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, Wilbur Mills, urging him to use his powerful influence to speed the bill through the conference committee. On February 26th, 3 short months after Kennedy's assassination, the tax bill passed both houses. At the signing ceremony, Johnson lavished praise on Senator Byrd, chief among the half-dozen men he had termed his partner during negotiations. That Byrd had allowed the majority to work its will despite his continued opposition to the bill was the mark of a gentleman and a scholar and a producer. To sweep away stagnation, to get things moving in this lethargic Congress, Lyndon Johnson had used every straw of the broom. Furthermore, he made it clear to Congress and his administration that he was now prepared to brush aside all other pending legislation to clear space for a single-minded focus on civil rights. Master the power of narrative. Lyndon Johnson, like Abraham Lincoln and Franklin Roosevelt, knew that people were more easily influenced by stories than any other way, that stories were remembered far longer than facts and figures. So now, when talking with civil rights leaders and die-hard Southerners, Johnson told variations of the same personal story to underscore his conviction that the ironclad system of segregation that had governed daily life in the South for 75 years, the Jim Crow laws that prevented blacks from entering white-only public restaurants, bathrooms, hotels, motels, lunch counters, movie theaters, sports arenas, and concert halls must stand no longer. Every year, Johnson related, his longtime black employees, his housemaid and butler, Helen and Jean Williams, and his cook, Zephyr Wright, would drive his extra car from Washington back to Texas. On one of these arduous three-day journeys, Johnson asked Jean if he would take along the family beagle. Johnson was surprised when Jean balked. "He shouldn't give you any trouble, Jean. You know Beagle loves you." Jean was reluctant. "Well, Senator," Jean explained, "it's tough enough to get all the way from Washington to Texas. We drive for hours and hours. We get hungry. But there's no place on the road we can stop and go in and eat. We drive some more. It gets pretty hot. We want to wash up. But the only bathroom we're allowed in is usually miles off the main highway. We keep going till night comes, till we get so tired we can't stay awake anymore. We're ready to pull in, but it takes another hour or so to find a place to sleep. You see, what I'm saying is that a colored man's got enough trouble getting across the South on his own without having a dog along." At that juncture, Johnson had confessed, "There was nothing I could say to Jean." He told another variant of this anecdote to segregationist John Stennis of Mississippi after the senator vehemently denounced the public accommodations section of the Civil Rights Bill. "You know, John," Johnson said, "that's just bad. That's wrong. And there ought to be something to change that. And it seems to me if the people of Mississippi don't change it voluntarily, that it's just going to be necessary to change it by law." Still another version of this story was told to civil rights advocates when asked why he was so passionate about ending Jim Crow. "It was just plain wrong," he told James Farmer, leader of the Congress of Racial Equality, "that Zephyr Wright, his college-educated cook, had to go squat in the middle of the field to pee. It was humiliating. Something had to be done about it." And now, for the first time, Johnson concluded, the country finally had the makings of a real answer for Jean and for all black Americans. If the Civil Rights Bill currently stonewalled in Congress could become the law of the land, blacks would no longer have to suffer the indignities of an outmoded and cruelly unjust system of segregation. No, for what and when to risk it all? The proposed bill surely contained the most flammable social, political, and moral issues and the most deeply personal ones Johnson had ever taken on. The chances of failure were large. My strength as president was then tenuous. I had no strong mandate from the people. I had not been elected to that office. The next presidential election was only 11 months away. Nor was the decision taken without a tremendous sense of personal loss. It was destined to set me apart forever from the South, where I'd been born and reared. It seemed likely to alienate me from some of the Southerners in Congress who had been my loyal friends for years. And yet, there comes a time in every leader's career, Johnson said, quoting Franklin Roosevelt's poker-playing vice president, John Nance Garner, when he has to put in all his stack. I decided to shove in all my stack on this vital measure. As a consequence of the civil rights movement, the country was changing, and so was he. Johnson intended to use every ounce of strength he possessed to achieve passage of the Civil Rights Bill. Civil rights leader Roy Wilkins was immediately struck by the enormous difference between Kennedy and Johnson. Where Kennedy was dry-eyed, realistic, Johnson was passionate. Both Martin Luther King and Whitney Young also came away from their first meetings with the new president, profoundly impressed by his deep convictions and the depth of his concern for civil rights. Indeed, Martin Luther King told friends that it just might be that he's going to go where John Kennedy couldn't. Rally support around a strategic target. In the House of Representatives, the Civil Rights Bill was stuck in procedural limbo by Virginia's 80-year-old autocrat, Judge Howard Smith. A defiant Smith had predictably used his authority as Rules Committee chair to prevent his committee from holding hearings to establish the rules of debate, without which no bill could even proceed to the floor. Meanwhile, the frustration of civil rights leaders mounted, and in the streets, tensions escalated. As Johnson analyzed the situation, he concluded that only one option remained, a rarely used House procedure known as a discharge petition. If a majority of the members, 218, signed the petition, a bill bottled up in committee would be blasted onto the floor. Since House members generally felt protective of seniority and the traditional committee system, however, only a handful of discharge petitions had ever become law. Johnson acknowledged that it was a mighty hard route, but at the same time he understood that the fight for 218 signatures would give civil rights supporters a specific target to consolidate what was otherwise an ill-organized campaign. And he knew that for Judge Smith, no charm offensive would work. Without coercion, Smith would piddle along, delaying hearings all through winter and spring until summer came, and it was time for Congress to adjourn. Johnson understood that direct presidential meddling on a question of internal House proceedings might compromise the chances for the discharge petition. So instead, he worked to pressure members from the outside in. During his first 2 weeks in office, he met with civil rights leaders, liberal groups, union leaders, church groups, and members of the business council. He reasoned, prodded, pleaded, and in the end inspired them to make the discharge petition their priority. Then day after day, he followed up with dozens of phone calls, which, fortunately for history, he secretly taped. These recordings reveal the conversational dexterity of a master strategist at work, providing a far more complex portrait of leadership than the bullying transgression of others' personal space, the jabbing index finger, and the simple-minded quid pro quo generally described as the Johnson treatment. He began with civil rights leaders A. Philip Randolph, Martin Luther King, and Roy Wilkins. He didn't want to be quoted, he told them, but he suggested that they concentrate all their focus on getting every friend to sign that petition the moment it's laid down. Call on your supporters in Congress. Go to see them. Create a sense of momentum. This ought to be your all strategy, and I want you to be thinking about it. He reached out to liberal groups who had long been skeptical of his leadership. If I've done anything wrong in the past, Johnson told Americans for Democratic Action founder Joe Rao, I want you to know that's nothing now. We're going to work together. He told David McDonald, head of the United Steelworkers of America, that if there's ever a time when you really need to talk to every human being you could, this is the time. They'll be saying they don't want to violate procedure. He warned everyone and offered the talking point. Just say that the humblest man anywhere has a right to a hearing. The drive for Democratic signatures from the North and West quickly totaled 150. But to reach the magic number of 218, 50 or 60 Republicans would be needed. Talking with members of the Business Council and with former officials in Eisenhower's cabinet, Johnson disclosed a dramatic new line of argument. He told them to tell their Republican friends there was no longer a place to hide behind procedure. You're either for civil rights or you're not. You're either the party of Lincoln or you ain't. By God, put up or shut up. In private phone calls to prominent journalists and editors, he laid out an attack against those unwilling to sign. Point them up, he told the Washington Post's Catherine Graham, and have their pictures and have editorials. Ask them, why are you against a hearing? Whatever man is against a hearing to bring the bill to the floor where it can be voted on its merits is not a man that believes in giving humanity a fair shake. A few days later, the Washington Post published an editorial, Friend or Foe, which made the precise argument Johnson had outlined. Let the members of the House make no mistake about it. The test is at hand. They will determine the fate of the Civil Rights Bill by their willingness to sign the discharge petition before they go home for Christmas. This is no less than a test of the capacity of Congress to meet an inescapable and historical challenge. When after 2 weeks the number of signatures had climbed to 209 and was still rising, a ranking Republican member of the House Rules Committee approached Howard Smith. "I don't want to run over you, Judge, but nothing more needed to be said." Smith capitulated, avoiding the indignity of being relieved of responsibility for the bill. On December 9th, he promised to hold hearings as soon as Congress reconvened after Christmas. When the hearings concluded, the bill was finally brought before the floor on January 31st. The majority succeeded in striking down every amendment that would have substantially weakened the bill. Between the moral force of the civil rights movement and Johnson's skillful use of the bully pulpit, a consensus had been built. While to some people, Johnson noted in his memoirs, the word consensus meant a search for the lowest common denominator, that definition belied the prime and indispensable obligation of the presidency to decide first what needs to be done regardless of the political implications, and then to convince the Congress and the people to do it. For Johnson, a successful consensus was the consequence of effective persuasion. On February 10th, by a clear margin, the House of Representatives passed the strongest civil rights bill since Reconstruction. The wheels of democratic government were at last beginning to turn. Draw a clear line of battle. As Johnson prepared for the Senate fight, he made it absolutely clear that this time, unlike 1957, he would allow no significant compromises. "I knew that the slightest wavering on my part would give hope to the opposition's strategy of amending the bill to death." Uncharacteristically, the master bargainer and wheeler dealer had drawn a line in the sand, and upon that outcome, Lyndon Johnson's relationship to his heritage, to his political career, and most of all, to his vision for the country's future, hung in the balance. To make his position transparent, he invited Richard Russell, leader of the Southern opposition, to join him in the White House for a Sunday morning breakfast. In less august circumstances, they had established this intimate tradition many years before. "Dick, I love you, and I owe you," he began. "I wouldn't have been leader without you. I wouldn't have been vice president, and I wouldn't have been president. So everything I am, I owe to you. And that's why I wanted to tell you face to face, because I love you,